serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 75 years since a World War II effort that is often overlooked but certainly never forgotten by anyone who took part in the largest airborne operation ever carried out on a single day in a single spot on the map. Operation Varsity dropped nearly 17,000 American, British, and Canadian troops into combat against German forces near Wesel, Germany on March 24, 1945. For one of those American paratroopers with the golden talons of the 17th Airborne Division, he never would have known his real name if it wasn't for World War II. The oldest boy among seven children in his family in Uvalde, Texas, Julian Mazuka, would spend most of his life as a sheep shearer, keeping his skills sharp by cutting the hair of his fellow soldiers during World War II. We'll get to his memories of that Operation Varsity jump, but let's start with his recollection of December 7th, 1941, and the journey that news of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor started for him.
I remember that very well. I was in Arizona working in the ranch or someplace, and I remember well.
What did it mean to you as a young man? You were just 20 years old at the time.
I don't know what to say. What I mean, it's not very good.
Did it occur to you at all that what was starting to happen might involve you at some point, that you might have to do something?
Yeah, I know that. And that's when I reached for the service. And I had a different name. I don't know. My name was Julian Mazuka. They used to call me Pedro. And when I went to register for the service, they had to take my birth certificate. And there was Julian. And I asked my mother, how come they call me Pedro and my real name is Julian? I said, your grandma changed your name because you look like your grandfather.
So they've been lying to you all those years?
For a long time. And from then on, I know that I have to use my right name, Julian, and that's what I use my right name.
So all your buddies in the war certainly called you by that name. But you didn't go right away. How many deferments did you get and why?
Three. Yeah. Three deferments because I was ship churning and I got a chance to 6 months in each deferment. And after three deferments is no more, they called me to go on for my physical. And the next day, I mean, the same day, they called me, and I was in there at 11 o'clock, giving the papers, put me in the train to San Pedro, to Los Angeles, and they picked me up in Los Angeles, take me to San Pedro, and they put uniform on me.
Going to San Pedro is almost enough to make you want to change your name back to Pedro.
Yeah, almost.
But what do you think your expectations were about going in the Army? Because by this time, February of 1944, there's a lot that's been happening. You probably heard about some of this war overseas.
Well, I was not afraid to. I was willing to go and do my service. I had a lot of offers to go to Mexico and forget about going to service. I said, no, I'll stay here. If the rest of the guys go, I go. And that's where I went. And you know, to be a paratrooper, that's a big commandment. You have to raise your right hand and you said, they asked if you're willing to jump any place, any time to defend your country. And I said, yes, I do. And that's what they put the wings on after you qualify, make 5 jumps.
Before we get to any of your jumps, I want to find out how you ended up being a paratrooper, because most guys don't get drafted and get stuck in that. You probably had to volunteer somewhere. Had you ever been in an airplane before?
No, never been in an airplane. And the guy, we was in a basic training in Little Rock, Arkansas. A couple of weeks before we finished the training, they takes to the theater and show how they want to volunteer for paratroopers. And the guy that was my friend who was staying in the same barracks, his name is Tony Maris. He said, let's go and be signed for paratroopers. I said, no, I don't say, yeah, we got the guns too.
That must have been a good movie.
So we signed up, and about a week later, they called us for another physical, and he didn't pass the physical, and I do.
So he pulled a fast one on you. He's the one who got you to volunteer, and he didn't have to do it, huh?
Yeah, so.
So you grew up in Texas. You joined the service out of Arizona, came to California for training, all the way across to Georgia. You saw a lot of the country. But had you ever been on a ship before they shipped you out?
No, I've never been.
So what was that like? What do you remember about heading overseas?
Well, it was very nice. We went back to the boat called La Quitinia, the largest, biggest in England, got 13,000 troops. And we land in Laka Beach, Scotland. And then from there, we were on a train all the way to London. And to London, we crossed the channel again.
Did you get seasick at all on that journey?
I never got seasick.
How was the food?
Very good. We eat twice a day, but we were all right.
You had a birthday cruise, huh? You had your birthday on the ship?
Yeah. It was in January 28th.
What did they do for you? Did anybody know it was your birthday?
Nobody knew. Just myself.
Do you remember what you were thinking going overseas? Because here your family didn't want you to go. They wanted you to go to Mexico and avoid all this. And here you are heading overseas. What do you think you were thinking at the time?
I was young. I didn't think something about it. Just if something happened, it's going to happen. If it don't, that's it. That's the way that feels.
Did you get letters from home?
Oh, yeah. My folks used to write it to them.
And you moved pretty quickly from Scotland into England, then across to France. And what did you find when you got there, where all that intense fighting had been months earlier?
Well, everything was destroyed when we went in France, especially when they crossed the channel. That town was completely demolished.
What was it like to see that? Because I imagine you'd never been anywhere where that was what was in front of you.
Kind of surprised me to see something like that. I mean, I didn't figure something like that. But
were you anticipating the first time that you would actually jump when it mattered, when this was an actual mission against the enemy? What do you remember about the build-up to that?
I know we were going to jump, and we had to do the best we know. You know, but a week before jump, we studied everything. They briefed us everything. What canals and power lines and all of that, everything. And we know what we're supposed to do. As soon as we hit the ground, we know exactly what we're supposed to do. And like we jumped 10 minutes behind the 2nd Battalion. By the time we hit the ground, our bullets go in all directions. Airplanes burning, houses burning, and that's a big mess. When we jump, we try to go to Berlin. That's where you're supposed to go. And this is where we roll. I mean, we soon hit the ground. We two divisions jumping in the same place, Englands and Americans. The England went towards the Rhine, America, we went towards Berlin. And we put mountains on days on the front line before the Second Army take over.
Yeah, so you had over a month of frontline combat after parachuting in, but you guys took off from France. This was an absolutely massive effort. While the ground troops are hoping to cross the Rhine, you get dropped on the other side of the Rhine, behind enemy lines, and you landed near Wesel, Germany, determined to fight your way to Berlin. I know how to spell it, W-E-S-E-L, but where exactly is Wesel?
It's 25 miles the other side of the Rhine. And from then on, we go all the way to Berlin, and that highway, I mean, they call it Autobahn. Yeah. That's a big freeway going to Berlin. Some of the guys were on the left, some on the right, and we go straight up. Every day we march. We take a little town every day, one or two towns, and sometimes we burn places because we get a fire, and we happen to go that way, they burn the whole town. Quite a few towns we destroy.
I know that most of your experience was on the ground, but I want to get this picture. I'm sure a lot of people are fascinated by how this all started. And I imagine it struck you, the magnitude of this, when you guys were taken off. How many different airplanes full of paratroopers were going? I mean, there must have been a lot of birds in the sky, so to speak.
There was.
Was it kind of awe-inspiring to see so many planes going up at the same time?
Surprised me to see something like that. And surprised me when the Second Army take over. Well, all day, they don't have to fight. They give us a rest. They take over, and the following day, Germany surrendered. So I don't think they had to fight a bullet. They're going straight on.
You guys did all the work for them, I guess. But I did look up the statistics on Operation Varsity, and I want the folks at home to picture just how immense this was, with all the C-47s and C-46s, one of which is at Castle Air Museum in Atwater now, by the way, the C-54s, the gliders, the fighter escorts. This airborne armada stretched 200 miles in the sky. And how about this? For the entire force to cross any given point on the ground took more than 2.5 hours. That's how many Allied troops were in the sky on March 24th, 1945.
Tell me also, what was it like
jumping out of that C-47 on this mission. So you guys get to where you're supposed to drop, and then it's time to actually do this, what you've practiced so many times and trained for. Do you remember that moment when you exited the airplane and how that all unfolded?
Oh, yeah. I remember very well, but that's what we're supposed to do. That's so how we do it.
Were you nervous at all jumping out? Were you confident you'd get it right, that your chute would open, that you'd land in the right place? I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, I was thinking, I hope nobody hit me. That's what I was hoping, no bullet hit me. And luckily, nothing happened. Soon they hit the ground, and we're ready to go. And we started to go where you're supposed to go.
And what all were you armed with?
M1.
You had an M1 rifle. Did you have any grenades? What else were you carrying?
We got some grenades and M1 ammunition. And we had a fruit for 3 or 4 days, K-rations, they call it K-ration. And that's all, the blanket and the things in the back.
How soon did you encounter the enemy? How long did it take before you saw the enemy and they were shooting at you?
The sooner we hit the ground, we can see bullets coming in all directions, the house is burning, and we're ready to go. You see somebody, it's the enemy, we let it go, we let it have it. Ever since they moved, we shoot him.
Were you scared?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I never had scared. I mean, I just hope it's nothing. Nobody hit me, and that's it. Yeah, I was very lucky and nothing happened. Not even one scratch.
You said you weren't scared. And I guess maybe if you're going to be successful as a paratrooper, maybe you need to put that out of your mind. But where do you think that came from? What convinced you that you were going to be okay and you were going to make it through all this?
That's pretty hard to say. I don't know. I was young. I don't think nothing bad going to happen to me, but I was willing to take whatever they come. I don't think about that. When your time comes, and that's it. I'm the hard believer. When the time comes, and that's it. No matter what.
How did it affect you the first time you saw one of your fellow paratroopers get killed in combat?
Well, I see quite a few. Yeah, especially my company commander. He's right close to me. Not very far from somebody shoot him right in the head. Down he went. 3 days after we jumped, we got some tanks come and help us. And we were supposed to be behind the tanks. And he got a little bit to the right. And they got hit. And we lost quite a few.
Did that trouble you? Did that make you wonder if you were going to be next? Was it just painful?
They don't see. That's when the tanks come and that's it. Maybe that was helping me. I was afraid of nothing.
So would you say you kind of got numb to it?
Well, yeah, and I was a little bit crazy. You know, when they crossed the canal after 3 days, there was quite a few. There was a machine gun to the left, a machine gun to the right, and I got on top of the left and looked around, and the sergeant said, "Hey, Julian, get out of there. You're gonna get hit." I said, "They don't like Mexicans."
And it worked, I guess. You must have been right.
I mean, right. By golly, Tony Garcia, he's the one that chewed those two machines, one on the left and one on the right. He sneaked in, and boy, he hit it. He got a silver medal for that.
Silver star for taking out those machine guns. Is that one of those things, sticking your head up like that? Is that one of those things you look back on now and say, what was I thinking?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I said, when the time comes, the time's coming. That's it. Don't worry. I don't worry about things.
Well, I'm glad your time didn't come right there, because you got a couple daughters and 5 grandkids and 5 great-grandkids who wouldn't be here if it did. When you think back about all that, is there one moment that you think was your closest call, the closest you came to when your time comes, your time comes?
Well, when we crossed the canal, I was trying to get in a tree, and I get to see me, and they was shooting. I could see the bullets hit the tree, and it was pretty close.
But nothing ever hit you? You never wounded at all?
Not even when they jumped, and we got no scratch or nothing. Some of the guys got scratches and all of that, and broken legs and some of that, but I didn't have no problems at all.
So this is the spring of 1945, and the war in Europe ended in May of 1945. Did you guys have a sense that you were getting close to finishing this up, that you were about to defeat Germany?
But a couple of weeks after we jumped, they tried to give up. Sometimes we got as much as 500, 600, they wouldn't surrender. They come and said, that's it, they don't want no more fight.
So you guys would take him prisoner and get him somewhere?
The sergeant said, 3 volunteers, you go get him. So we're going to bring it in. One America in the front, and one in the left, and one in the right, and one behind.
You just march them around like that. There was a situation where you personally captured three Germans?
Yeah, well, I wasn't even in the front line. Some of the guys were about a mile ahead of us in the front line. And we go by to the haystack. And when I went by to the haystack, I smelled something like a human beings. And I said, I smell something here. And the guy said, yeah, somebody shot at you. I said, no, I smell something else. So when I kick the hay, here's three Germans inside of that haystack.
Wow.
As soon as I hit the hay, and they started moving the legs, and they here come.
So were you checking every haystack you saw after that, or what?
Not very many haystacks, and I happened to go in that one. And this was.
Well, and let me ask you about that. I don't know how many of you guys there were, but was that a situation where they were just hiding and hoping nobody found them, or was that a situation where they had weapons and could have killed you if you didn't see them?
They had no weapons.
Yeah.
They tried to survive because we check everything and there's no weapons inside of us. I guess they throw their weapons or hide them someplace. So I don't know, but they're trying to.
Well, you know, another interesting question, I guess, to ask, and I've had different takes on this one, too, is how did you feel about the Germans, the guys that you were fighting, the guys that almost killed you a couple times? How did you feel about the enemy?
Yes, like us, you know, when something, we in the front line and something happened, we use the same guys to pull the ones that got wounded. The same Germans, they helped to help, and we did the same to them. They got hit, they're in bad shape, we get them out and help them out.
You saw some of your medics help out wounded Germans?
Yeah, we do quite a few then. We get them out and they're in bad shape, they want to survive.
When did you find out that Germany surrendered, and what was that moment like?
I feel there was something big. We don't have to fight no more.
Did you guys celebrate a little bit?
The Second Army take over, we got quite a bit of relief. We don't have to be in the front line. The Second Army take over. And the following day, they surrendered, so they don't have to do very much.
Yeah. So you guys had already gone back for R&R, or what?
Well, after we do that, they changed to another camp. There was a little town they call Oberhaus in Stuttgart. And they had a German camps, in it, I mean, a Russian camp. They all those prisoners, they got ahead of them in those camps. Mm-hmm. And they used to get up in the nighttime and do quite a bit of damage. So we put a quite a few from 6 to 6. They're supposed to be out after 6 o'clock. They had to be in the camp. And they were always doing, watching those things.
Did you hear at any point during this time about the concentration camps and about what the Germans had done to their political prisoners and the Jewish people?
I was in the camp. I see some they are in bad shape. Some already died, and some was ready to be dying and put in bad shape. I mean, not even one, quite a few.
When you saw that and realized what those people had been through, how did that affect you?
Well, it's pretty hard to see those poor guys dying and put in bad shape. They didn't have nothing. We try to help as much as we can, but I know they need help real bad. In July, they dissolved the 17th Division. And in August, they transferred me to the 82nd. And then the 82nd sent me to Japan. And we was in, and we get the boat from Marseille. We're supposed to be in Panama Canal in 7 days. And we rest, I don't know, about a week. And then we go to Australia. And from Australia, we're supposed to jump someplace in the Pacific. But 2 days before we come to Panama, Japan surrendered. So they turned around and came to Virginia. And I was here 3 days later. 4 days later, I was in the United States.
Well, I know it was a long time ago, but let me ask you about that. Because here, you've been through this war in Europe, and you've seen so many guys like you get killed, and you've come close enough yourself to find out that they expected you to go over to Japan and go fight another enemy. Was that something that was hard for you to swallow, or no big deal?
We were very happy to go that way. We already whipped Germany. We're going to whip Japan. In July, they dissolved the 17th Division. In August, they transferred me to the 82nd. And then the 82nd sent me to Japan. And we was in, and we get the boat from Marseille. We're supposed to be in Panama Canal in 7 days. And we rest, I don't know, about a week, and then we go to Australia. And from Australia, we're supposed to jump someplace in the Pacific. But 2 days before we come to Panama, Chopin surrendered. So they turned around and came to Virginia, and I was here 3 days later, 4 days later, I was in the United States.
Well, I know it was a long time ago, but let me ask you about that, because here you've been through this war in Europe, and you've seen so many guys like you get killed, and you've come close enough yourself to find out that they expected you to go over to Japan and go fight another enemy. Was that something that was hard for you to swallow, or no big deal?
We were very happy to. We already whipped Germany. We're going to whip Japan.
So then were you disappointed when you didn't even make it to the Panama Canal?
Disappointed because we didn't make it.
I'm sure at some point that disappointment turned to celebration, right?
Yeah, well, they did.
What did it feel like to be back in America after everything you'd been through?
Oh, there was feel something. Especially when you get out of the boat and you see flags and a lot of saying that you can let your heart come to your mouth.
Made you emotional to see that.
Very excited.
And what about seeing your family again?
Well, they was nice too. When they see you and they know that nothing happened too.
You marched in some parades when you got home?
Well, yeah, we was given 30 days furlough. And then I went back to San Pedro and gave another 30 days furlough. And then I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's where we stayed. And then when the 82nd came from Europe, we meet them in New York. And we marched in New York, we marched in Washington, D.C., we marched in Philadelphia.
What did you see in those places? What kind of reception did you guys receive?
Well, everybody treats very nice, very, very nice.
I've had a lot of guys tell me that America was different then, and that there was a unity in this country, that everybody believed in what you guys were doing, and you were all in it together. Did you feel something like that?
Well, I was very proud of what we do. I feel very proud of myself, and I'm very proud of what I've been doing.
And it sounds like they made you feel like they were pretty proud of you, too.
I think so.
When you think back on all of that now, everything that you endured, everything that you went through, being a paratrooper and a World War II veteran, what are you most proud of?
Well, I guess what I did, I was very proud of what I did. And it's something that nobody can take it away from you. So it's something you remember the rest of your life. It's those guys that got killed and they didn't come home. And we think lucky was like me. Nothing happens.
Those who survived tell the stories that help the rest of us understand the magnitude of the sacrifice for those who did not. That's all the time we have on this edition of Hometown Heroes. If you're interested in more on Operation Varsity, make sure to track down that 75th anniversary commemoration online on Tuesday, March 24th. As we all step gingerly into this uncharted territory the coronavirus pandemic presents, let's remember that we really are all in this together. I'm Paul Leffler saying thanks so much for listening and reminding you again that freedom is not free.